you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My pleasure to have Dr. E. Michael Jones back on the show. He's here to discuss his article in the October edition of Culture Wars magazine, The Rise and Fall of the New Atheism. Dr. Jones is a historian, prolific writer, and editor of Culture Wars magazine. Among his many books are The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, Its Impact on World History, The Slaughter of Cities, Barren Metal, A History of Capitalism as a Conflict Between Labor and Usury, and the most recent, The Broken Pump in Tanzania, Julius Nyerere, and the Collapse of Development Economics. His books and a subscription to Culture Wars can be purchased at culturewars.com. Dr. Jones, how are you doing this evening?
Good, Jim. Good to hear from you.
Well, nice to hear from you, too. Thanks for coming back on the show. And, well, you wrote this fairly long piece for Culture Wars, your magazine, The Rise and Fall of the New Atheism. And from what I understand, it's part of a book you're working on, too?
Yes.
Okay.
The book is it's tentatively the history of Logos and the Logos of history, and it's about about one word. The word is Logos. There's the old joke about the Greek professor who dedicated his entire life to studying two words, men and death, which in Greek means on the one hand and on the other. And he was dying, and the students gathered around him, and they asked him if he had any regrets. And he said, yes, if I had it to do all over again, I'd concentrate on death. So I'm sort of following in that tradition. But obviously, Logos is an important word. And it's an important word. I have to use it because we have no equivalent in English. Mm-hmm. And the best proof of that is the beginning of the Gospel of St. John, which we've all read since we were children. And the first sentence is, in the beginning was the Word. I have no idea what that means or what it meant. I spent years, not as if I sat up late at night losing sleep pondering it, but every time I read it, I couldn't tell what was going on until I studied Greek. And then I realized that there were five pages in Liddell Scott's ancient Greek lexicon just for one word, because it was such an important word to that culture. In many ways, this word is in many ways the basis of Greek culture and the reason why we still think that Greek is an important language and why the Greeks are the foundation of our let's put it this way, one of the pillars of the civilization we live in. Mm-hmm. Now, just as to take a step back from this point, as you know, I've been traveling around a lot, and mm-hmm. been two of the places I've been are India and Iran. And part of what I'm realizing is that pretty much if you take those three places, that covers a large part of human culture on the face of this earth. Because what you're talking about is the Anglo-American Empire, which rules the world and certainly dominates the Anglophone world where people speak English. Islam, which is also a huge world unto itself. And India, which is also a huge world. Now, I could probably include China in this, but I haven't been to China, so I'm just going to leave China out. Because I think what these three cultures have in common is, first of all, that they were all interconnected during the period that I'm going to talk about at the beginning of the book, namely the 6th century BC, when the term Logos came into existence. It came into existence through, obviously, it's in the Greek language, but I mean, it came into existence as a philosophical concept with Anaxagoras, who was one of the Ionian philosophers, Ionia being a Greek colony in Asia Minor. So you have here kind of the intersection of Persia and Greece at this time, would eventually lead to wars between these two countries. But if you have an intersection between Persia and Greece, you also have an intersection between Greece, Persia, and India. All of these countries were related. They were people trampled back and forth, invading each other. India never invaded anybody, but it was invaded by both Darius, and Alexander the Great, and these concepts. So at this crucial moment, the world sort of comes to an understanding that there's a basic reality out there. It's not water. This is what Thales of Miletus, also an Ionian philosopher, the first Ionian philosopher, that's what he said. You know, it can't be anything material. It's got to be something spiritual. And the term that Anaxagoras used was logos on the one hand, and nous, which means mind, on the other. And it was out of this, suddenly across the world, this world, if we want to talk about a large chunk of the civilized world, you had this concept emerging. In India, it was the Vedas talk about Rita or RTA. The Zoroastrians talk about Ahura Mazda. The Greeks talk about Logos. And at the same time, the 6th century, you have the Hebrews writing the book of Genesis, which is about beginnings. And that's what my article is about. It's about beginnings, because when you talk about beginnings, you're talking about metaphysics. And when you're talking about metaphysics, you're talking about God.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you'd be in the article, The Rise and Fall of the New Atheism, is sort of, it's appeared out of the blue. But in the context of... Well, it's about 10 years ago, so talking about the first decade of the 21st century. And you relate that this new atheism, this phenomenon, to, events of that time? Or was it like right. a convergence of a certain cultural...
Well, it was like a dance craze or a moral panic or something like that. Mm-hmm. Really, it was, everybody was talking about the new atheism. Four books came out, books by... Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, and Sam Harris, all on the topic of atheism. All people, professors or writers or journalists, all standing up and thumping their chests about how macho they were because they didn't believe in God. Some people say that it was a reaction to the threat of fundamentalism, both Islamic and domestic, which is to say Christian fundamentalism. I think there's a better explanation, which I would like to get into as we get along here. Mm-hmm. But I think it was a sign of a crisis, because I think now we've got a severe crisis throughout the world. And by the world, I'm going to say once again, the Anglophone world, the Islamic world, and India. all have a crisis, and the crisis is basically a metaphysical crisis, a crisis of foundation. No foundation. Okay? That's what these three empires, these three cultures have in common. The oldest, of course, is the Indian or Hindu culture. They were the ones that basically, they started out, as I said, in the 6th century, there was this universal attempt to come up with something, 6th century BC, to come up with some type of understanding of the basic structure of the universe. The Indians made a brave, a valiant beginning with Rita, and then the whole thing collapsed in India. And India became the classic example of a country with no logos, as Hegel would describe it. The symbol of Indian cosmology is the earth is a semicircle. It's sitting on the back of four elephants, and the elephants are standing on a turtle. So what's the obvious question now?
What's the turtle standing on?
Absolutely. And the answer is on the internet. It's turtles all the way down. Well, that's not an answer. You can't have turtles all the way down. But what you see now is this wrecked Indian culture. Sorry, it wrecked Indian culture. They lost their moral bearings. Usury became rampant. And not only did usury become rampant, usury became codified in the cultural system. And it was known as the caste system. So basically you had the Brahmin caste, which were basically the creditors, and you had the untouchables who were the lenders, and it was sanctified as a religious construction. Okay, that foundationlessness is now symptomatic of the entire world. And so I dealt with the crisis which came about in the West, which seemed to be, at the moment, the triumph of secularism, you could call it that. Atheism is an extreme form of secularism. And these guys were standing out there just saying, they just kind of threw all caution to the wind. You know, they're all Darwinists. Every time you open this book, you immediately get involved with Darwin. Darwin is the operating system of the American empire, the Anglo-American empire. There's no question about it. If you go to Harvard, as my son did, and you want to get into the club like the Porcelli, and you better tell them you believe in Darwin, because otherwise you're not going to make it. And if you make it in that club, then you become a Rhodes Scholar. Well, Rhodes Scholar, I guess Cecil Rhodes was the empire builder. He was, you know, spreading the theological underpinning or the philosophical underpinning of all this is Darwin. And that's precisely what you realize when you read Richard Dawkins' book or Christopher Hitchens' book. It's all Darwinism. And Darwinism is, in a sense, anti-metaphysics. And so what I think happened here, as in what Hegel would call the cunning of reason, is this outburst of atheism backfired. And in a sense, it brought about the collapse of the whole paradigm that is upholding the Anglo-American empire. So suddenly you look at the Anglo-American Empire, and guess what? It's turtles all the way down for the Anglo-American Empire as well. And that's what these books brought, in effect, made obvious for the final time. They ripped the veil off. They said, this is what we really believe. This is what it's all about. And in doing that, they overturned their own ideology.
Yeah, and coming out as sort of a vocal or extreme atheist, fundamentalist atheist, they forget the undeniable fact that atheism itself is a metaphysical claim that must be justified. And it cannot be justified on logic. And then that's when they start getting into mentioned Dennett's book, where he claims the universe itself was created itself ex nihilo. I mean, just nothing came out of something, but it wasn't quite nothing, which is a logical absurdity.
So to cut to the chase, the only philosopher among the group, Dennett, makes the incredibly stupid statement, the universe created itself ex nihilo. And then to give the full statement, he says, or out of something very small. This is ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous. Okay. for a philosopher to say something like this. First of all, Professor Dennett, here I am raising my hand in the front row. Professor Dennett, if it's something very small, even if it's really, really small, it's still something, isn't it? Well, that means you've already – this is what you need to prove, okay? This is a circular argument here, okay? But let's forget he said that. Let's not embarrass him too much by saying something that stupid. Let's stick to the first part of his argument. The universe created itself ex nihilo. That means the universe had to exist before it existed. Well, can you explain that to me, Professor Dennett? Can you explain how that's possible? No, you can't, because it's impossible. You just made a colossal philosophical error, okay? And so what you have here are a group of, I don't offend anyone, but a bunch of metaphysical ignoramuses. Complete ignoramuses. Okay, so I think I mentioned this before, but I mean, if you know, I get calls from Press TV. You know, usually it's like 5 minutes. Okay, 5 minutes. We're going to talk about Yemen. Okay, okay. I'm going on about Yemen. So let's say Professor Jones comes on and says, "Now Yemen, okay, Yemen is the problem with Yemen." Is it surrounded by Brazil and Argentina? Well, wait a minute. They'd laugh me out of the place, right? Well, this is the equivalent of what these people are saying. Dennett thinks that Yemen's in South America. He doesn't even know what he's talking about. You can't do metaphysics with biology. You can't do it. It's impossible. Yet that's exactly what all these people try to do. They try to turn biology into metaphysics. It can't work. Now, there's a tradition, and what I'm referring to here is the English ideology. The English are notorious for this type of crap. And the most notorious example of this was Sir Isaac Newton, who was a little bit smarter than these guys because he tried to use physics, turn physics into metaphysics. That's not going to work either, okay? But at least it's more sophisticated than what these guys do. Biology is not going to work. You can't create a metaphysical argument out of biology, and that's precisely what they try to do.
You I heard you relate another interview. It was a radio show with Dawkins and a gentleman called from Scotland.
Oh yeah,
can you relate that story? I like that one.
Yeah, so it's an atheist talk show host, and there's Dawkins, and they're just insufferably pompous and smug. You know, and this poor guy from Scotland calls up and starts talking about how Jesus entered his life and saved him. And you can see it's radio, obviously, but you can tell they're rolling their eyes when this guy's talking. And then the guy suddenly turns the tables on Dawkins and he says, "Well, Richard, was there ever something? Was there ever nothing?" And Dawkins doesn't know what to say, you know, yes. He said, "Well, if there's ever nothing, then there can't be something." And then Dawkins doesn't know what to say. He's completely dumbfounded by an obvious statement like this. Yes, obviously, nothing can come from nothing. If there were ever nothing, no, there can't be something. Okay? So he says, "You need to read a book." Okay. I guess that's a good answer, isn't it? And then on top of that, he makes it even worse, but he says, "I wrote 8 books." Well, congratulations. You wrote 8 books. Well, God bless you, Richard. But you didn't answer the question.
No, yeah.
This is the question you cannot answer. You simply cannot answer it because you can't get around the fact that there is this move from nothing to something, which you can't negotiate.
Yeah, there is, now, as you said, there's a lacks the appreciation for the metaphysical chasm between being and nothingness.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's nothing. There's no intermediary stage.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Professor Dennett. Even if it's really, really small, you know, it's still something. So there's no intermediate phase between nothing and something. Now, the interesting thing is when you start to get into these biological arguments, the evolution arguments, the same applies. Okay, now either an organ can see or it cannot see. If it cannot see, if it can see, if it's an eye, if it can't, it's not an eye. There's no intermediary stage here. And this is precisely what they both try to fudge here, because the essence of Darwinism, and this is the fundamental pillar of their atheism, okay? The essence of Darwinism is we got a lot of time now. Before, everybody thought the world was 6,000 years old. Well, now it's a lot older than that. It's millions of years old. And we can have little steps over a million years. I mean, anything can happen, right? With little steps over a million years. Well, no, I'm sorry, you can't. Because you can't get from blindness to sight, even if you got a million steps. This is precisely their ignorance of the metaphysical argument, okay? Because it's very similar to the proof for the existence of God. Mm-hmm. Okay? Now, I was in India. And I was at this high school in Delhi, and it was a group of 16-year-olds, and I gave a little talk, and then the teacher says, any questions? And kid raises his hand, and he says, can you prove the existence of God? Now, I think this is an important statement, an important event, because I think this is precisely what India craves at this point. What has been missing in India is this type of logos, because India has religion. I went to the temple of Ganesh in Mumbai, you know, and saw the little statue of Ganesh, the gold statue. I saw there's a silver rat. The Hindus put a wreath around the rat's neck, and they whisper in the rat's ear, and he scurries off and carries the prayers to Krishna or somebody. Okay, you can worship monkeys. There's a monkey god, Hanuman. You can worship cobras. There's probably nothing in India you can't worship. You probably find a temple for everything, including the guy who murdered Mahatma Gandhi. There's somebody worships him, too. There's actually a temple dedicated to him. Now, if you can find the logos in this, let me know. I don't see it. I just don't see any logos in worshiping monkeys. But if you don't like that, well, that's okay, because then you can leave the temple of Ganesh and you can go to the Nehru Science Center, which is real. Okay, that's religion, but this is real. And so you're waiting to get in. You know, it's like classic 1950s Tomorrowland. And there's a big mural there. And it's the beginning of the mural. It's like the whole history of the universe right there on the mural. The beginning of the mural is atoms formed. Now, I'm sorry, fellas. This makes the worship of Hanuman, the monkey god, look rational by comparison. This is completely preposterous. What do you mean atoms formed? As I said before, in another instance, you mean shit happens? Is this your explanation of the universe? Is this like turtles all the way down? This is like the scientific version of turtles. So this is the world that Samuel lives in. Okay. And that's why he asked me the question. And I said, yes, I can prove the existence of God. You got the right guy here. I said, nothing comes from nothing. There is something. Therefore, there was never nothing. This something cannot bring itself into existence, because to do that, it would have to exist before it existed. That's impossible. So therefore, something else had to bring that into existence, and that something is what all men call God. Okay? That's the short version, because, you know, he's 16 years old, and I'm up there, and, you know, anyway, he liked it. I don't know where – I don't know what he's thinking – whether he's still thinking about it now. But, I think it was a successful communication. Now, what I didn't say is that there's the long version of this thing, which is you could say that, maybe it was created by a demiurge. Maybe it wasn't God. Maybe it was a demiurge, you know, like half God or something like that. Well, the same thing still applies. Mm-hmm. In other words – did something create the demiurge? If something created the demiurge, then he's not God. Then we're back at square one. If the demiurge is God, well, then that's the end of the story. And then that's what I just said. So let's put it this way. Let's translate this into Darwinian language. Suppose you had a whole real long line of demiurges. This is what Darwinism is. We got a lot of demiurges, and if you have a lot of them over a long period of time, then you don't need a god at the end of it. Well, sorry, that's not true. That doesn't work. And so I cited at this example in the article Ed Fazer's argument about the caboose. Okay, the caboose is moving. Why is the caboose moving? Well, because it's attached to a boxcar. Okay, well, why is the boxcar moving? Well, the boxcar is attached to another boxcar. Well, why is – so you could go down the line and say, well, how about if we have this is Richard Dawkins' argument. Well, we have a lot of boxcars. if we have a really long line of boxcars, we'll move the caboose. Well, no, sorry, Richard, that doesn't work. That doesn't work. That's the kind of typical Darwin stupidity. Okay, the only reason that those boxcars are moving is because there's a locomotive on the front of the train. And no matter how many boxcars you have, it can't make up for a locomotive. The locomotive has power of motion. The boxcars do not. So this is the argument from motion. There has to be an unmoved mover or an uncaused cause. That's the classical definition of the term we use. I use the term of the bridge, which is from the opposite point of view. You want to build a bridge, you have to get in the middle of the river, you sink a wooden form, and then you pump the water out of the form, and then you reach the bottom. That's mud, usually. And then you can't start building on mud either because mud moves. So you have to keep going down and down and down until you find something that does not move. We call it bedrock, generally, okay? And then once you find bedrock, once you find something that does not move, then you can start building the bridge because otherwise the bridge will collapse. Now, what Dawkins and his friends are saying is, well, no, we don't need to go to bedrock. We have a lot of bricks. We have a lot of cement. As a matter of fact, we have an infinite number of bricks and cement. Well, I don't care if you have an infinite number of bricks and cement. If you keep pouring them into that hole and you don't find bedrock, it's not going to matter. And that is the whole point of that I didn't go into about the proofs for the existence of God. But the whole proposition stands. And I'm saying that the whole world right now is in crisis because the whole world lacks this metaphysical foundation. That's the crisis we're in right now.
You speak of Darwinism or evolution sort of being the guiding philosophy of the Anglo-American Empire, the Anglosphere, and you just trace its roots as far back as Newton, the Newtonian vision of the world, and his banishment of a theology or a meaning to the universe. Can you explain that?
Yes. Now, this is something I've already written about. It's in Barren Metal, mm-hmm. and I do it from an economic point of view. But basically, Newton was an alchemist. He was the last alchemist. The crisis in English culture came about with the Reformation. Once the Reformation was a looting operation. I'm going to get in trouble, I know, when I say this, but there is no theological justification for the Reformation. Mm-hmm. Certainly in England, there was no any. I mean, you had Luther. It was a looting operation in Germany, and Luther, wrote a lot of theological treatises and so on and so forth. But it was still a looting operation over there. But in England, there wasn't even a Luther. There's nobody there. It's just greedy, rapacious aristocrat stealing church property. That's all it is. And maybe some Anglican bishop that sprinkled holy water on it. But that's all it ever was.
Yeah, you have what's the R.H. Taney quote?
Great. He's a great writer. He's wrong most of the time, but he's a great writer.
Yeah, he says the upstart aristocracy of the future had their teeth in the carcass, and having tasted blood, they were not going to be whipped off by a sermon.
Yeah, that's such a great image, isn't it?
I wrote that quote down because I knew I was going to be able to use it tonight. So,
so that's the whole story in a nutshell. The aristocracy had its teeth in the carcass, and they weren't going to be whipped off by a sermon. Mm-hmm. And so the regime lost all legitimacy whatsoever. And they had their philosophical guy was John Dee, and John Dee believed in magic. And so magic was basically the operating system of Elizabethan England. And Shakespeare, it's in Shakespeare. It's in the plays at the time. Marlowe wrote Dr. Faustus. Dr. Faustus is John Dee. Prospero is John Dee. The difference between Dr. Faustus And Prospero is Prospero says, okay, I'm getting out of the magic business, closes his books. It's like, no, you don't get out of the CIA or the mafia. Okay. And so the best realistic version is Marlowe at the end of, Faustus at the end of Marlowe's play being dragged into hell, shouting, oh, Christ, oh, Christ. And the demons drag him down to hell. Okay, that's a more realistic version. But so this was the crisis of Elizabethan England. This didn't give him legitimacy. You know, it was a nice fantasy, but there's no legitimacy here. And then the whole regime collapses when Mersenne just demolishes Flood in an argument, exchange of letters, and Descartes becomes the philosopher of the new world, of the new age, of the modern era. And the English are sort of behind the times until Isaac Newton arrives. Now, Isaac Newton was an alchemist just like John Dee, no difference. He and the other paradigm of the English Enlightenment, John Locke, engaged in alchemical experiments in his apartment in Cambridge, trying to turn lead into gold or something like that. So much for your rationalism, folks. But Newton basically smuggled in he used, again, the same as it's like classic English ideology. He used physics and the inverse square law and this type of stuff, which is true, to smuggle in a pagan cosmology. Mm-hmm. The pagan cosmology is basically from Empedocles and it's love and strife. The universe is made up of love and strife, except that he called it gravity and inertia. The gravity and inertia are love and strife. And this creates perfect circular motion, which means you don't mess with the universe. Now, this comes out most clearly when you apply this to economics, which is what Adam Smith did. He called it self-interest and competition. The universe is perfect, so you never interfere with the system, which is something the oligarchs love to hear. Don't mess with my system. I'm making money hand over fist. Don't talk to me about anything else. Just laissez-faire. Leave it alone. And that's eventually becomes down to Darwinism. Darwinism is also basically a use of some form of science to rationalize the status quo. In this case, the fact that the ruling class is the ruling class. They ascended to this by biological determinism. So how can you argue with these people? This is the argument of Darwinism. It's survival of the fittest, which is, if there were ever a circular argument, is survival of the fittest, which means basically, okay, don't send grain to Ireland because this violates some type of law.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it comes down to.
Yes, yeah. And then, of course, the full title of Darwin's book is The Origin of Species by Natural Selection or The Preservation of the Favored Races in the Struggle for Life, which
right.
is telling.
So you're talking about a period of time here. The great comeback of Logos that began with Kant's synthetic a priori continued up till 1831, which was the year in which Hegel and Goethe died. And Logos then recedes into the background and a new ugly form of materialism takes over European thought. And the classic example would be Karl Marx, but also just this scientism. And also basically what we're talking about is racism. Let's be honest here. Darwinism is racism. And we had a period at the end of the 19th century, large amounts of anthropological research, archaeological research of really first-rate significance. Schliemann excavating Troy, what he thought was Troy, discovering all of this Mycenaean civilization and so on and so forth. Something happening across the world. Wilhelm Schmidt, the Catholic divine word priest, doing the grammars of Asia and beginning serious anthropological research in these cultures that were still primitive, you know, while the primitive cultures still existed. You know, now they all have cell phones, but back then it was something worth listening to. And unfortunately, it all got sidetracked by this materialism. Wilhelm Schmidt wrote a book, huge book. It just warms my heart to see someone writing a book that's about six times bigger than the books I write. It was called the Ursprung der Gottesidee, the source of the idea of God. And it's about all of these research he was doing, anthropological research, firsthand in various cultures. And what he discovered was that basically the more primitive the culture, the more monotheistic it was. Polytheism is a later form of decadence, and India is probably the classic example of that kind of decadence. But what he said, that invariably anthropological research was wrecked by Darwinism. Because Darwinism is the exact opposite paradigm. In other words, there's always progress with Darwinism. And the evidence that Schmidt found throughout the world is that decadence is the rule. It's not progress, it's decadence. The more primitive people all had a belief in monotheism and a heavily moral understanding of the universe. And it all got displaced by decadence, and in other words, the theological term for decadence is polytheism.
And it's interesting that the English world would pick up Darwin and this idea of constant flux and progress, because that also is very similar to the ideas behind Freemasonry.
Well, Freemasonry was basically... The Whig Party took over the Masonic lodges in 1721, mm-hmm. weaponized them. And how they weaponized them was basically Desaguliers, this Huguenot, was basically Newton's assistant. Newton was the godfather. I mean, he didn't believe in anything. I don't know why he made him godfather. But anyway, he was Desaguliers' child's godfather. And Desaguliers was the man who brought Newtonian physics into the Masonic Lodge. Mm-hmm. And then the Masonic Lodges got spread on the continent, and they became the agents of subversion that eventually led to the French Revolution and the fall of the House of Bourbon. So it was always a weaponized ideology from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying that's what it is today. I'm saying, and that's why I think we have a crisis now, because it doesn't work. I'm sorry. They're still teach it in schools. You can't. My late Jewish friend Sam Shapiro used to berate me because I was so dumb that I didn't believe in Darwinism. And he said all the people in the biology department believe in Darwinism. All the people at Notre Dame biology department believe in. I said, well, look, everybody in the biology department in the Soviet Union believes in Lysenko too, but that doesn't mean it's right. No, actually, my favorite Sam Shapiro anecdote is that I'm out of town, and my oldest son's father-in-law, Yuri, the Russian biologist, is visiting, and I'm not there. So Sam kind of just walks into my house, plunks himself down on the sofa in the living room, and he says to Yuri, "Who are you?" And Yuri says, "I'm Adam's father-in-law." And he says, "Well, what do you do for a living?" And he says, "I'm a biologist." And at this point, Sam says, "Do you know that Adam's father doesn't believe in evolution?" And Yuri says, "I don't believe in it either." And I wasn't there to see the look on Sam Shapiro's face when he said this. But anyway, that's the type of thing we're talking about here. Yes, it's an article of faith, but it's over. I'm saying it's over. It doesn't work. In a sense, if I said something wrong, if there's something irrational about what I said, please point it out to me, okay? Because I'd like to know myself, okay? Now, if what I said is true, then certain consequences follow. And the consequences are, for example, well, if you're an atheist, you're irrational, okay? Now, you can be irrational because the will is free. That's the way God created us. But if this is the case, we have to shift the terms of the discussion from ontology or cosmology to psychology. Mm-hmm. Because we really need to talk about is your problem. You've got a problem. You've got psychological hang-ups. This is the only reason the only way we can explain irrationality, right? If it's irrational, then we have to find some type of psychological cause. And it turns out that there are people who have done this, okay? And I was in many ways instrumental in this as well. I'm talking about Paul Witz's book, Faith of the Fatherless, which is basically Paul Witz is a psychologist at NYU. He's probably retired now. But back in the 80s, we published Infidelity Magazine, which is the forerunner of Culture Wars. We published his article where he kind of floated this idea, which is basically, if you look at all of the famous atheists in history, they have one thing in common, namely father problems. They have problems with their father. And this is significant because obviously God and father are related. And there's no one who said this better than Sigmund Freud, who was like the classic example of the atheist with a father problem, because he said God is an exalted father. Well, he's right. He's right. Not in the way he thinks he's right, because he thought that he just exploded all of theism. No, no. From a psychological point of view, you're right. Because we get our idea of God from our fathers. And if our fathers are weak or undependable or in some sense inadequate, we have trouble believing that there is a God.
Mm-hmm. So the attempt to kill God, so to speak, is sort of Freud would say it was the Oedipal complex type thing, right?
That's exactly. So Freud did come up with a good explanation of why people want to kill God. Well, because you want to sleep with your mother, right?
Well, that's obvious.
That's everybody does that, right?
Yes.
Well, Sigmund said, Freud said it, so it must be true.
I like one of your lectures, you're talking about this, and I forget which lecture it was or when it was, you go, and you present Freud's theory regarding this obsession with having sex with one's mother, and you go, I have to admit, this wasn't immediately obvious to me.
But it was to Freud.
Yes, it was his problem.
He's famous, and I'm not, so.
Yeah.
But, I mean, basically, that mystery has been cleared up as well.
Yeah.
Because Freud said, with your mother or your sister.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that he had this sexual obsession with his sister-in-law. And he actually did consummate that relationship. He portrayed in Moses and monotheism, he talked about this as a kind of divine thing, because the Pharaoh was known as a god, and he was, because he was a god, he could only marry people within his own family. Mm-hmm. So, but Freud got it from Barrowell. It's very clear. No, let's get the chronology straight. Freud got it from Nietzsche. It's in The Birth of Tragedy, and Nietzsche got it from Barrowell. And Nietzsche was part of this whole revolutionary movement, which began with the Illuminati. And the Illuminati, the people, the organization founded by Adam Weishaupt in Bavaria at the end of the 18th century, they had a system of control which they called Seelenanalyse. And if you translate that into Greek, it's called psychoanalysis. Well, this is where Freud got the idea of psychoanalysis. Okay, it was from the Illuminati, and it was the Illuminati program was basically the whole Jesuit idea of examination of conscience turned upside down. So the Jesuit, you go to the priest and you examine your conscience, you come up with your sins, the priest gives you absolution, and he says, go and sin no more. The psychiatrist, on the other hand, because he's part of the Illuminati, uses this as a form of control. So what you go to the psychiatrist, you tell him your sins, and he says, okay, it's okay if you want to do that if you make a big contribution to the psychoanalytic society.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what Sigmund Freud did with Horace Frink, the American psychologist, a medical doctor. And I tell that story in Libido Dominandi.
Nietzsche also, he lost his father at a young age too, right?
Yes, yes. Nietzsche, there's a chapter in Witz's book on Nietzsche. Nietzsche, there's a crucial stage in development where you disconnect from your mother and you identify with your father. Your mother is unconditional love. Your father is the reality principle. In other words, your father helps you negotiate with the world, how to get along in the world. He is the principle of order, just as God is the principle of order. The father represents Logos, just as God represents Logos. And Nietzsche's father was an evangelical Protestant minister. And he died when Nietzsche, I think it was between around 5 years old. Crucial moment. Nietzsche loved his father, and then suddenly he feels abandoned by his father. And he feels that because of that, that God is not reliable, or there's this anger. In Nietzsche, it's more than just a sorrow. It's anger. Like, why did my father leave me? I had to be raised by all these women. I hate women. Nietzsche was a misogynist. He was just raised by women. Where was the father? Well, he almost found a father in Richard Wagner. He absolutely idolized Wagner. And then Wagner wrote Parsifal, and that was the end of Nietzsche's relationship with him. Because Nietzsche felt that Wagner had capitulated and bowed down before God. But there is this anger. Okay, this rage against God, and you find that also in these people. Now, a good example here, if Professor Witz is in the front of the class, okay? Witz, by the way, did a new edition of Faith of the Fatherless where he dealt with the new atheists. And he mentioned Dawkins. Dawkins went to an Anglican boarding school and was sexually molested by an Anglican priest. And so, therefore, you can see the anger that he would feel by transposing this to religion. And then there's Christopher Hitchens. Now, this is an interesting case because Christopher Hitchens has a brother, Peter Hitchens. Mm-hmm. And Peter Hitchens is a conservative. And they both had the same father. Now, Peter Hitchens talks about his father as the naval hero. And he was in the British Navy. The British Navy is an important institution in England. Growing up in England, Peter Hitchens talks about this in his book, The Abolition of Britain, how, every schoolboy learns about what a great guy Sir Francis Drake was. We would call him a pirate and a terrorist, but the English, they have a funny way about this. If you it's in the Pirates of Penzance, but basically, if you steal a spoon in England, they'll hang you. But if you steal a country, you steal all the church property, or you steal all the gold in the Spanish Armada, they make you a knight. Okay.
Yeah.
So the story, the message is: be big, be bold, and steal a lot, and you'll become a knight in England. So his father's part of that operation, descendant of Sir Francis Drake, and they sink the German Navy in one huge battle. And that's the father that Peter Hitchens sees. Well, after the war, the British couldn't afford their Navy anymore, so Hitchens' pair got downsized. And this is, in a sense, the father that Christopher sees. So it's one and the same guy, but at two different phases in his life. And one guy, he's the courageous, warrior. The other guy's kind of like an accountant, who's trying to skimp by because he got kicked out of the Navy. Now, what's the difference here? And I think this is what I would raise as my counterexample to Witz. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient, this fatherless thing. The crucial thing, I think, is moral behavior. Okay? And this is where you see, Peter Hitchens is open about his early life. He's no saint, but he's a repentant.
So this is the sexual revolution period, right?
This is the sexual revolution theory. So basically, Christopher got swept away. They both got swept away by a sexual revolution, but Peter repented and Christopher did not. And Christopher went on to dump his wife and pick up and ran off with some Jewish chick who made his career for him. And eventually he became a Jew. this is really funny. He discovered that his mother was a mother troubled situation. That the mother commits suicide after she runs off with a lover, but there's Jewish blood. And then he says, this is why I've always been a revolutionary. I have Jewish blood in my veins.
sounds like Hitler.
This was really fun. Christopher, there was somebody who thought that way. It was Hitler. This is basically the Hitler view of race. And this is what Hitchens now believes. It's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But anyway, this, I think, is a crucial issue. Because what you see here is, once you are committed, you've got this weakness. It's very similar to homosexuality. Homosexuality is also father deprivation. Okay, that's the only real plausible explanation of homosexuality. There is no gay gene out there. Sorry. But what these people have in common is they're not affirmed by their fathers in some sense. They feel some type of lack. And the crucial thing that happens with a homosexual, they have this tendency. It's not either moral or immoral, it's simply a flaw that you have. It's like you grew up with missing an arm or something like that. You know, it's a psychological flaw, but it can get sexualized. And this is where the predatory older homosexual comes in. I don't know whether this is part of gaydar or not, but they sense that these young guys, this guy in Penn State, I forget the guy's name now, the coach at Penn State who went to jail and nearly destroyed Penn State, Joe Paterno's assistant.
Oh yeah, you ran that the Second Mile Club. Yeah, you said the name, I'd get it, but I know his son is now in trouble. Yeah, but
anyway,
yeah, I know.
This guy knew this. He was a predator.
Sandusky,
that's right. And he used the psychology department at Penn State to find out vulnerable young guys. This shows you how vicious this guy was. But that's what happens here is this can get sexualized. These vulnerable kids can get sexualized, and then they get habituated to a very bad habit. And at this point, you can see the rage starting to grow. And I don't know whether you saw that recent video of the homosexual in Seattle.
Yeah, you and Peter Helen talked about it.
We talked about it on our YouTube video. Yeah. Well, this is like homosexual rage. They're basically pro-lifers are coming in from the cold after handing out leaflets, and the homosexual barges in and says, "Get out of here. I hate you." You know, and then what's going on here? You're going to get rid of customers? What kind of business is this?
Mm-hmm.
What you have here is this rage at anything that reminds him of what he is.
And Logos.
Yeah, yes. Because he's in rebellion against Logos, and that's what adds fuel to this fire.
It's funny because you think pro-life, you think okay, they're opposing legalized abortion, they're trying to and he himself is making connection between sex and babies,
right? And wait a minute, you guys don't have a dog in this fight, do you? What's your problem?
Yeah, but in a way philosophically he does.
Yes, of course he does.
Yeah,
because he knows that there is a logos to the human body. He knows that the sexuality has a logos that is a teleology that directs it toward procreation. And he knows every time he engages in sexual activity, he deliberately thwarts that intention.
Mm-hmm.
And that fills him. Whenever you remind him of that fact, he's filled with rage and wants to kill you or kick you out of his club.
Well, this gets us to the big question. Why evolution? Why this obsession to deny the existence of God? I mean, we dealt with it personally. I mean, there's Peter Hitchens, I like how you put it. It's almost like Peter Hitchens writes off his misbehavior as, well, I'm genetically programmed to be a jerk. Nothing.
That's Christopher Hitchens.
Yeah, I'm sorry, not Peter. Christopher Hitchens.
Not Peter, Christopher.
Yeah, Christopher, I'm genetically programmed to be a jerk, more or less, because this is just the way I am. Nature designed us to be this way. This kind of writing off moral failure, blaming it on God, but not God, so to speak, but natural selection, which is their God. But yeah. With these supposed Gang of Four, and Mr. Vitz has this fatherless this father problem hypothesis, which I think has a lot of validity. And of course, in a society where you have high rates of family breakup, dysfunctional families, single family household, single parent households dominated by women with no fathers, you're gonna get more of these people having these problems.
I think that's the explanation.
Yeah.
That's what I said at the beginning of the program. Why suddenly did we have the new atheism? Well, it's a logical sequel to the sexual revolution, which is basically father, in a nutshell, it's fathers shirking responsibility for their offspring. That's basically what the sexual revolution is all about. You know, the Playboy philosophy, you name it, that's what it comes down to, the basic thing. And so you had children raised in a fatherless environment, and so therefore they can't conceive of God. because the only image they have of God is their father, and that's not adequate. That's inadequate. It's mm-hmm. too. It's too weak. If God is weak, then he's not God. And that explains the new atheism. I think that's the best explanation of it.
And of course, with the British Empire itself, or the Anglophile world, you alluded to it earlier, is this necessity to expel God, to expel purpose from the universe. That's what Newton did with his physics. But then it was applied philosophically, economically, by Adam Smith in the 20th century. It's sort of this justification to be completely liberated from morality in your conduct, both personal and public, right?
That's right. And the oligarchs, that's what the oligarchs wanted. They wanted to be liberated from morality because morality is a check on their power. So be careful what you pray for. You were liberated from morality, and then everybody got liberated from morality, and now you've got England as it is today, which is a mess. Mm-hmm. Probably going to be taken over by Muslims because you wrecked it. Okay, you being the oligarch ruling class, the Rhodes Scholar boys, Darwinians. You wrecked it because you drove out moral causality, and once you do that, everything collapses, and that's what we're seeing right now.
So how do we bring order? How do we reintroduce order into the universe then? How do we turn this around?
We don't reintroduce anything. The order is always there.
Yeah.
Is what we do is we expose the failure of their ideology. Mm-hmm. Now here we get into something that is extremely mysterious from my point of view, because it is the fact that if one man has the idea, it seems to spread all over the place, and they can have all of the universities under their control and all of the TV stations, and yet the idea spreads, and ultimately it's not going to work. It's similar to what I said about the bricks. You know, you can have mm-hmm. an infinite number of bricks, but if they're all false, it's not going to hold up anything. You know, and I think that's what we're seeing now. We're seeing the collapse across the board of the conventional narrative. And Trump's election was an example of that. Trump is a disaster. His attack on the nuclear agreement with Iran is only the latest instance of his folly. But it was a protest against the oligarchs' rule, and it was an expression that the conventional narrative does not hold anymore. I'm going to say the same thing about Harvey Weinstein. Okay. Mm-hmm. The Hollywood conventional narrative is imploding as we speak as well. And I think that basically Harvey Weinstein was offered up as a scapegoat by Steven Spielberg. And Steven Spielberg's ancestors are the ones who said, it is better for one man to die than for the people to perish. So I think it's better for Harvey Weinstein to get knocked off for sexual harassment than for all of Hollywood to go crashing down around him. I think that's what we're seeing now. But that's another story. That's mm-hmm. a whole other
story. Yeah. That's interesting. He's the fall guy when we all know that type of behavior and much worse behavior pervades Hollywood. Pedophilia.
Really? Like, are you kidding me? I'm shocked.
The casting couch didn't begin with Harvey Weinstein.
I'm shocked. There's gambling going on here?
I'm shocked. Yeah. Okay, we got cut off there, but that was Dr. E. Michael Jones. He is the editor of Culture Wars magazine. The article we discussed was The Rise and Fall of the New Atheism. That article can be read by purchasing the October edition of Culture Wars magazine. Of course, you can also purchase Dr. Jones' books at Culture Wars or at Amazon, and also get a subscription to Culture Wars magazine at culturewars.com.
Oh.